Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Buddy, Jacob Daniel here, another episode of the Daniel 3 podcast. Thanks for tuning in tonight. Episode 70, it is a late April edition of the call-in show. I haven't done one in a few months. Last time I did one was January. And I had a light schedule this week. I didn't have a lot planned. And so I went to Twitter and was reminded that I actually had somebody who I had scheduled to do a call-in show a while back and never got around to rescheduling it. So we're going to have him come up in just a minute, and we're going to have a conversation about borders, immigration, and sort of the dichotomy within libertarian thought on open versus closed. He will be kind of coming from more of a closed borders perspective, and I will be defending more of an open. So we'll get into that in a bit. Before we get into that, do a little bit of basic housekeeping. Of course, every episode I have to talk about my sponsor, Rabbit Eye Blueberry Wine. If Jesus was walking the earth today and, you know, in the middle of flipping tables or, feeding the crowds of 5,000 because they're a bunch of freeloading vagrants that Rothbard hasn't been able to clear off the streets, he would be turning water into not grape wine, but blueberry wine. It'd be Rabbit Eye Blueberry Wine. So check that out. My good friend Will Bell, who you guys probably know from the he's in the comments, I see, trolling me a little bit. He has tried to assert that Spider-Man had a better morality than the Bible. That's what you get. Listen, get kids. Atheism, that's what it does to your brain, okay? But they still make good blueberry wine. What can I say? So, Will's a good friend, and we're just messing with each other a little bit. But yeah, Rabbit Eye Blueberry Wine. This stuff is I'm not much of a wine drinker, but he's got me into it. My poor Jack Daniels is sitting in my liquor shelf, just collecting dust since I started drinking this blueberry wine. So definitely check that out. Support libertarian entrepreneurs, right? I mean, I think that's definitely worth doing whenever you can find a way to substitute going to the store and buying something with supporting libertarians. I think that's something that we should be doing as a movement. Website is going to be relaunched next week. We kind of finally got all the kinks worked out, but we're past the main hurdle, but that's daniel318.com. So that'll be back up. If you're your first time watching the show, or if you haven't yet, click the subscribe button, and that way you'll be alerted to any future episodes I release. And you can follow me on Twitter at Biblical Anarchy. As far as what's coming up ahead, Tomorrow, I'm going to have a sort of round table of other Christian anarchists. Caleb Brown is coming back on, as well as I don't know how to say their name. It's like Ancath, I guess. It's like Ann as in like Ann or Ironcath, I guess, like Ayn Rand on Twitter. They kind of go anonymously, but their Twitter handle is Ironcath. So they're going to both be coming on the show tomorrow. Maybe one more will be joining us. I'm not sure yet. But we're going to have a conversation. Probably it'll end up being about Catholicism. Because I've had some, if anyone's following me on Twitter, you know, I've kind of been talking a little bit lately about how I'm done with Protestantism. Doesn't mean I'm embracing Catholicism yet. I'm still in that middle ground of, I don't know what to do. So I don't know. I'm still, you know, I like to be just honest with you guys. I don't, you know, I'm not going to pretend to have it all figured out. You know, none of us have it all figured out. This is a journey, and we continue to develop our ideas and continue to talk to different people, read different things, and, you know, continue to pursue the truth. All right. So, Frank, I will, I don't know if Will is still watching. If he is, he can post a link. If not, I can make sure to put that in the show notes or something when I'm done. I should get better about doing that. So I'll definitely get you a link one way or the other. Okay, so done with all the introductions and stuff. So I'm going to bring up our caller for tonight. His name is Kyle. Kyle, how you doing?
I'm good.
All right. Well, hey, thanks for coming on. You know, Twitter is, I mean, I won't say it's completely useless for having conversations and stuff, but, you know, one of the reasons I created this call-in show was because a lot of times you'll get into debates about different things on Twitter and then realize that, like, it's just not a great space for actually, like, if there's two people who want to actually dive deep into a disagreement or a topic, it's not good for that. And so I was like, well, I have a podcast. Let me open it up to people. And I always appreciate, even if people disagree with me on a subject, if they're willing to come on and have a conversation. I don't know what your particular beliefs are, which we can get into, but, you know, my religious beliefs as a Christian, you know, one of the things the Bible talks about is iron sharpening iron. And so that's kind of what I view this kind of process as being. And so thanks for coming on. Maybe if you want to just quickly introduce yourself and your background and sort of where you're coming from as far as approaching this issue, what your specific political and philosophical leanings are, and then we can get into it.
All right. So I'll start sort of from the top. I'm a member of the Church of the Nazarene. I was born and raised in there. So that's sort of my religious belief. I went to some other churches when I was in college, but then came back to the Church of the Nazarene. A lot of people haven't heard of us. We're sort of a more conservative Methodist denomination. So oftentimes a little less heavy on the liturgy, though not exclusively so. I have heard that there are some High Nazarenes. I've just never met any myself. And politically, my background, actually, when I was around 18, I became a sort of Tolstoyan, not full pacifist, but I was reading, I'm not sure what exactly got me on Tolstoy. I was reading a bunch of sort of classic political theory texts. So I was reading like Locke and Mills, and somehow I wound up with Tolstoy in there. I think probably my undergrad was in English education. And so I think probably I saw Tolstoy and I thought, oh, like the novelist. So I added his thing to my list. And so from there, I sort of became a Tolstoyan. Over the next 10 years, I sort of became more and more Tolstoyan as I sort of realized, like, yeah, you know, to the point where, like, I was an absolute pacifist. Never went vegetarian. So never a perfect Tolstoyan.
I was a vegan for 5 years or so. So, but I couldn't keep it up anymore.
But, and I went back to get my master's degree. And while I was doing that, I killed a lot of time reading. And I've always been sort of into more traditional, sort of not necessarily right wing, but, you know, like I read a lot of Sowell and Locke and Mill and stuff. And I had read Hayek when I was doing, when I was still teaching. I really liked Hayek. And I read somewhere that, you know, oh, well, Hayek's Austrian, but there are these other Austrian economists like Mises and Rothbard. And so I read, my first introduction to Rothbard was Man, Economy, and State. And I'd always been, again, like sort of weird capitalist Tolstoyan, because, you know, Tolstoy has some sort of more left-leaning economic views, but I thought, no, it's like capitalism kind of makes sense as a way if you really want to get rid of, you know, artificial violence, which is still something that I agree with, even though I'm no longer a pacifist. If you just want to minimize violence, if you want to have like as little violence as possible, capitalism is great. And so I was reading Rothbard and finding him really interesting. And then I read Anatomy of the State, which is partly inspired by Tolstoy, and Ethics of Liberty. And Ethics of Liberty puts a lot of people, especially more conservative people, off of Rothbard. But he was the only person that I'm aware of to ever mention Tolstoyans in the modern context. Because he actually mentions, like, here's how society, you know, an anarcho-capitalist society would be acceptable even to, like, Tolstoyans. And then someone was bullying me into reading Hoppe. And so I started in on Democracy, the God That Failed, which is sort of the meme Hoppe book. And around that time, I was sort of being led to question pacifism, partly because Tolstoy, you know, if anyone who's sort of a traditional Christian, when you look at Tolstoy, you have to get around the fact that he played fast and loose with scripture at times. You know, one of those things where it's sort of like, well, yes, it says like, him who sheds the blood of man, his blood too shall be shed. But you know, what does it literally mean? And it's like, wait, no, I don't accept that in other places. I don't accept the what does he literally mean excuse, you know. And like there are better and worse ways to do it. Like Cody Cook, Cantus Firmus, I think has one of the better arguments for Christian pacifism out there. In he wrote a book recently. Well, he has several books, but I was one of the sort of advanced readers for What Belongs to Caesar. And, you know,
Bob Murphy does a good job, too, kind of talking about how anarcho-capitalism sort of, you know, would lean more and more towards a sort of like pacifist society because violence is just more expensive and less optimal in a market sense. Yeah. So, yeah, I definitely. So it sounds like we're coming from, you know, somewhat of a very similar background in terms of, you know, I don't know if I would identify myself as a Tolstoyan, but that's just because I don't like labeling myself in such fashions. But big fan of Tolstoy, you know, I kind of also sort of exist in that sort of a null space between libertarianism and pacifism. I don't consider myself a pure, you know, any sort of forces evil pacifist, but I also I tend to, you know, probably in 99.9% of cases, you know, side with what the pacifist would recommend in most situations.
Yeah.
So,
well, yeah, and it's one of those things where it's like, if you're looking at it from a moral equation, I see anytime that you have the least possible use of force, that is ideal. So anytime where you wind up the day with no one having a legitimate claim to say, I've been aggressed against by someone else, that's ideal. So, you know, that's sort of the golden end objective is you wind up in a situation where everyone is saying, you know, I may not have been as perfectly well off or as happy as I could be, but no one aggressed against me and things are generally, you know, okay.
Yep. So the topic we were going to talk about tonight then is borders. So I guess the way that I figured might be the best way to go about this is that first I'll sort of explain my view on borders, you know, state borders, immigration and all that. That way you can know where I'm coming from and then you can lay out your beliefs and, you know, and then start highlighting any disagreements that you would have. So I would say that in general, you know, I believe in the more Austrian view that the only legitimate borders are private property borders. I do believe that libertarianism is, I usually define libertarianism as the rejection of the initiation of force or coercion against peaceful individuals. And the best way to achieve that is to maximize self-ownership and property rights, as it were. So that said, you know, that's sort of a moral, philosophical, you know, view of the world. We don't live in a society where, you know, those things are within our grasp, and we are doing our best to wade through the tangled webs of statism and authoritarianism and violence in our society to push them more towards what our ideals are. And, you know, many different avenues for doing that. But we have to kind of come up with sort of a triage of what we do in the middle of you know, wartime and the battlefield for, you know, how are we going to, what are we going to settle for? What are we going to advocate for while the state exists, you know, or if the state is always going to exist, what would we prefer as the most optimal solution that, you know, best approximates what our philosophical leanings would be. So, and, you know, I would say I've read, you know, the extremes on both sides. I'm familiar with Brian Kaplan, who's a very, you know, well-known libertarian proponent for open borders. I'm, of course, very familiar with Hoppe. I enjoy Hoppe and appreciate his work. Yeah, I know kind of both sides of this. And so I want to make sure that at the beginning, just point out that I view this as like a in-house debate, never kind of be one of those more Lalbert style libertarians who would say like, you can't be for closed borders and be a libertarian. I feel like, you know, the only caveat being I would hope, and I usually sort of assume in good faith, that those who are for quote unquote closed borders from the libertarian perspective would be for the least authoritarian way to enforce a border, that they would not be just like, you know, okay, let's line the border with tanks and landmines and men with guns and, you know, gun down people as they, you know, I mean, I would hope they would at least be trying to advocate for a more as decentralized and as humanitarian a border policy as one can manage with the state. I would not say that I am 100% in my bones opposed to any sort of closed border position. But I would say that in terms of both in a philosophical alignment and in a utilitarian sense, I do think that open borders is, I would phrase it, less problematic than closed borders on many fronts. Not across the board. There's pros and cons to each, and there are some things. There are some conflicts or compromises you do have to make with open borders. I mean, I would say so. Both open and closed borders are compromises on the libertarian ideal because state borders are not private, and so they're not technically legitimate. And insofar as state borders exist, they're always going to be illegitimate, and they're always going to distort what the free market would bear out. And so, you know, it's not ideal. I guess so. First, philosophically, what is the best approximation? Now, I know Hoppe makes a argument that other closed border libertarians have sort of adopted, which is sort of the net taxpayer argument. And it's sort of a, okay, well, we can sort of approximate what the, you know, net positive contributing taxpayers would want, you know, by sort of saying, well, would they want this, or here, what are all the things that we would reasonably be able to assume that they wouldn't want? And so then, you know, we would advocate for something based upon that, something that would be maybe more closer to a libertarian order, because libertarian order does not necessarily mean freedom of movement. It just means maximizing property rights. My issue with that argument, and I see where it's coming from, but I guess my philosophical pushback would be that, one, that is a slippery slope, because who gets to assume what the net taxpayer's opinion would be? To me, that's a very easy way to justify all sorts of, you know, increases in state power and or advocating for state solutions. So for one, that's my first initial pushback, I guess, is just that I do view that as a slippery slope. Beyond that, it also sort of assumes a sort of universality to what people would want. And the problem is, as libertarians, we should know that there is no universality to what people would want. There might be some regions where that's true, where they don't want a lot of immigration coming in. But there might be some regions that want a lot of immigration coming in. And so to assume a one-size-fits-all approach, at least when it comes to like a national border, I think is problematic. Now, if the argument was, well, leave it up to the states, less problematic. You know, if each state was allowed to be more self-deterministic in the allowing of immigration in and out, you know, not as much of an issue. And of course, continue to push for decentralization would be my preference. So that's my philosophical disagreement with that argument. In a utilitarian sense, you know, so I think the costs of having an open border are that, you know, there is, so this is something that Hoppe, Tom Woods, others have.
If I may preempt you for a moment, my case for border controls is entirely non-utilitarian. Like, I even have a note in here where it's like, utilitarian wise, I am like 100% pro immigration. Like, I don't see any utilitarian case, like, other than like a criminal background check at the border, maybe, sure, which, sure, you know, you could handle in a private society, no problem. You know, like, we would have background check services and whatnot. So, like,
okay, so would you,
utilitarian wise, we're in agreement.
Okay. So you would say, in a utilitarian sense, that there are more, well, let me put it the way I was going to put it very briefly. What I would say was, I think that there are more positives for individuals and for a, you know, maximizing as much as we can sort of property rights with or open borders, or even if it's not absolute open borders, something more closer to open borders than the opposite side of that spectrum with closed borders. Would you say you agree with that or disagree with that?
So, yeah, I would. So, like, to give sort of a background for where I'm starting from sort of Hoppe's idea of one of the problems with the state's intervention in the border is that it arbitrarily excludes people, and then working toward, well, what would be the justification then for, if we were to restrict access, what would those acceptable justifications be, and how does that work?
Okay, so let's get into that then. What are the so I guess I would want to know, what are the acceptable, well, I guess, just before I even ask questions, just, I guess, if I feel like I need to go back into the utilitarian arguments later, I will. But if you're seemingly trying to suggest that that's not the you know, going to be an issue where we would have any major disagreement, then I will, I guess, yield the floor to you for a little bit, give you, you know, 8 to 10 minutes to sort of lay out your case for, you know, whatever you are advocating for as far as the borders.
Yeah. And this is,
to be really clear, what I'm advocating for is either open borders or as close to that as we can get. I'm not like I wouldn't make perfect the enemy of the good, you know? So you can go ahead.
Yeah. And I'd like to point out that my own, like, personal preference is generally for very high levels of immigration, like, even compared to the current system. However, I do think that there are actually some issues that we need to deal with in order to bring that in line with principles. Like, I think it's an easy solution. You know, people like you and I maybe have put more thought into this than other people, but, like, when you see, like, these Cato Institute things where they're saying immigration is good for the economy, we should have immigration, it's like, no, actually, there are moral and ethical issues we need to get into before we open borders.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, one of the things I was going to cite was the, like, what Hoppe and Tom Woods have talked about, which is, like, the problem of forced integration, which is definitely a problem that like the Cato types don't they don't deal with, or if they bring it up, they go, well, that's just racist. And I'm like, well, that's not an argument. Like, you need to actually deal with, like, you know, there are actual historic examples. Like Murray Rothbard talked about this in a, I forget which, like something nation and state. I forget what it was. But he talked about how, like, when the Soviet Union was starting to fall apart, and how the open borders caused like a lot of, like, you know, people were flooding into, you know, different countries and stuff, and massively changing like the demographics of it, like, all at once. And then it was like, you know, a major problem for like the sovereignty of the local people that were there before, that felt like suddenly, you know, these outside people had come in and now were changing their way of life. And like, to act like there's not a problem when you have massive influx of people who have a different culture, different language, different, you know, background or whatever, is just, you know, naive to the world.
Yeah. So I'll sort of give like a top to bottom thing here. I have some notes pulled up, so I won't skip anything super important. So one of the first things that I feel the need to talk about whenever we talk about like immigration and whatnot is the distinction between public property and public lands, because public property is what, you know, from a Rothbardian perspective, we might identify as property. That is, you know, a subject of economic action that's been brought into being, taken out of, you know, either laying fallow or transformed in some way. So property would represent like actually claimed property. So it could be land, but it could also be like roads and infrastructure and whatnot. And then we also have public lands, which are lands that the government claims but doesn't do anything with. I have not seen anyone who is on the libertarian spectrum really argue that public lands should not be available to anyone, you know. And again, like, I'm late Rothbardian in my own personal outlook. Even though I've read Hoppe, I tend to agree more with Rothbard than Hoppe whenever the two are in disagreement, which is not very often. So part of that thing with the public lands thing is obviously the government's making some unsanctioned claims. So I'm not trying to argue that the government should be given any authority to enforce those claims. You know, if people were coming to take unoccupied land near the Rio Grande, which actually I think there's more private property built up on the border than we give credit for. But, you know, it's like, let's assume that we can handle not passing over anyone else's private property. You know, if there's a spot of land that the government has that hasn't used, who should have it? And the answer is whoever wants it. You know, like, that very much like doesn't matter national border. I'm not even a fan of the idea of citizenship. Like, I do not draw a distinction between citizen and foreigner from that level of, like, I don't really care when it comes to who can access property. The main distinction would be taxpayer and non-taxpayer, but obviously, since you're just looking at that from an economic perspective, you could buy your way in, and I wouldn't have any objection to that. I'm not necessarily like, you've been here your whole life, you have a special claim. And, you know, Hoppe is often considered to be sort of closed borders, but one thing that people don't mention is Hoppe also talks at length about how the state is causing problems by refusing to allow people to associate. So it's this sort of lose-lose, where the state, yep, force integrates people, and you have people who are unhappy about being brought together, but then you also have forced disassociation, where I want, right, to work with someone. And the problem that I actually see is we are very much on the forced disassociation side when we're libertarians thinking about the border issue, and we think, oh, we don't want to force people to be separated. And that is a very valid concern. But where I wind up at is always, you know, it's not aggression to tell someone they can't have something, assuming they don't have a valid legal property claim to it. And one of the issues with open borders is precisely because of how borders work, people typically do not have claims to property on the other side of the border. You know, and even like a familial relation doesn't necessarily earn you that claim to that property. You know, so it's difficult. You know, on one hand, I would very much like, oh, yes, invite people in. Anyone who gets an invitation from someone who's lawfully there can come in and accept it. You know, like, that would be the libertarian ideal in a libertarian social order. That is how it would work. So that's what we would want to work towards. But I actually think it's the nature of the state that makes it so that the state cannot invite people in and cannot just freely allow people in because of some of the stuff that's going on there. And I'm not necessarily in agreement with Hoppe over the net taxpayer thing, both because one, I think what we've seen is, you know, net taxpayers tend to have low time preference, tend to be involved in production. And if you're a producer, you would have more incentive to at least have freedom of movement, even if not, you know, even if you're not hiring labor from overseas, you would want as little control of flow of goods and people as possible. Like, that's just economically optimal.
Sure. Yeah.
So I don't necessarily draw it from that. But I do think there's sort of a couple things. One is basically all public property ought to be private property. And it either was taken from a taxpayer directly, or it was made with money gathered from taxpayers and then, you know, spent towards this other cause. And so my concern isn't utilitarian. It's not like taxpayers are losing money from immigration, because I think the very strict utilitarian argument there would be, no, immigration is generally good for taxpayers. Like, at least from a vulgar economic perspective of line goes up.
It's good on a macro level. I mean, and then it can be varied. You know, there's going to be winners and losers, of course, like with anything.
Yeah. But a lot of the losers aren't people who would have a claim to aggression. You know, like, I'm not the they took our jobs argument. It's like,
yeah,
no, if you're not willing to do it for the same price as someone else, that doesn't mean that they aggress against you by taking the job at a lower price. You know,
right.
Like, that there's no justification to claim aggression based on those arguments. So from a libertarian perspective, those would not be sufficient to close borders.
Although, however, it's funny when, just to quickly point here, it's funny though when that exact argument is made by both people like Tucker Carlson and Bernie Sanders. It always cracks me up.
Yeah. Well, and I think one thing is it's something that shows a different economic perspective. Because I've noticed from like a Chicago perspective or an Austrian perspective, you never hear this "they took our jobs" argument. And it's only people who have like other like Keynesian or like, I'm not really sure what the conservative equivalent would be, like if you're going back to like mercantilists arguing, because I mean, like, even Adam Smith, who, you know, might not be hardcore Austrian on certain things as far as the, like, you know, labor theory of value goes, would still argue division of labor. And so, you know, if you're thinking about division of labor, there's no excuse not to just have as many people as possible competing for the pie. So I'm not trying to make even necessarily a harm to the taxpayers thing so much as the government does not have the legal right to invite people on to seized property. Because it can't claim, you know, it can't claim that it was paid up as restitution for crimes, you know, as much as it may have acquired some of its goods somewhat legitimately from prosecuting criminals and having them pay for offenses. It also is taxing everyone. You know, it rains on the just and the unjust as far as taxes go. So basically, one half of it here is the government actually legally, like, if I were to move into someone else's apartment while they were away and invite my friends over, you know, it's not really ethical or legal for me to do that. You know, my friends might not be in trouble, but I would be in trouble for having done it. You know, and so I think, especially given the fact that the government tends to play winners and losers, that they're letting some people have access to taxpayer-funded property without having the same legitimate claims, you know. And of course, practically speaking, like, this isn't, again, like, I'm fairly pro-immigration, but it is something that I think we need to consider as libertarians, is if we really claim to respect property rights, we need to make a good case for why we're saying your property rights matter unless the government took your stuff, and then the government can give it away to whoever they want. You know, it's like, yeah, you're not seeing that again. Like, just from a political realist perspective, the money's gone. The government wastes like 80% of what it gets anyway. So, you know, you're not going to get repaid.
So what's the difference, though, between So let me point out where we agree, and then I can start asking some questions about where I'm not quite following you. So obviously, I agree with you. The state is taking either land that they did not homestead, they did not develop, and they are just kind of owning it via fiat, or they're taking property from, you know, somebody else. And so that, I mean, they're kind of the only two options as far as whatever the government owns. It's either owning undeveloped land or resources that they're just kind of saying like it's ours just because they, you know, they can, or they stole it. And then that becomes part of, I guess, the, you know, quote unquote public property or the commons, or, you know, whatever you want to call it. I certainly agree that that is immoral and unlibertarian. I think that nobody, this is where it gets tricky. So it's like, does anybody have a right to that public land? And does the state have a right to either give access to it, that public property, to people, or to deny access? So I guess to Steelman, your point, I think you're saying that maybe it's not ideal that they would deny access, but that it's not, I think what you're saying is not, it's not fundamentally unlibertarian to deny access because nobody is owed access, versus giving people access is actually increasing the net violation of property rights that the state is doing. Would that be a fair sort of summary or Steelman of your position?
And then, so your question is, well, why isn't it also wrong for them to let people who are, you know, taxpayers use it? If, you know,
yes, that would be my follow up question. Well, be like, what's the difference? Marianne, what about people who aren't taxpayers who are just born in the country and who are, you know, I mean, it seems so. It's basically a tragedy of the commons argument, which I get, but it seems to me like that problem goes in many directions, not just, you know, those who were born in the country versus those born outside of it.
Well, and so I have sort of a two-pronged response to that. One is, you are totally correct, it is immoral for a government to be letting everyone use that stuff. However, I would argue that the use claims of people who are already in the vicinity are maybe more valid than potential immigrants, because, you know, if you were to strip people of the access to it, for one thing, they were the ones expropriated to pay for it directly. But of course, then you wind up back in the issue of, well, why couldn't someone just pay to immigrate, which I actually love. I love that idea. But barring that, the case is, because the counterpart would be that you're basically kidnapping everyone. You're forcing them to stay on private property despite being surrounded by expropriated public property. So it's not. So, like, to answer your question, what should the state do? The state should immediately cease to exist. You know,
That easy.
That would be the ideal moral scenario.
Yeah.
And actually, you know, with regards to restricting access to people who are currently there, again, you know, I don't necessarily agree with the net taxpayer, because I think also we should consider the fact that, you know, let's say that you aren't having tax. Let's say even that you're a complete welfare beneficiary. You know, like, you have never paid a cent in taxes. Everything you've received in your life has been paid for by the taxpayer. I think you would still have a case for aggression against the state, that, you know, it moves it more into the situation where, like, what the scholastics would say, like, you know, if you're starving and you need a piece of bread, can you steal it? And the answer is, well, you can't steal it, but you can borrow it and you're still obligated to pay back. You know, so it's like, my gut feeling is, because if you're living inside state borders, you don't really have any real viable alternative to using public property. You sort of have sort of a dirty hands license to it, in the sense of, you know, potentially, you know, if we had the ideal Etienne de la Boetie style, people stop respecting government cease to exist, everything gets sold off in a fire sale. Potentially we might say, hey, you didn't contribute, you don't get a slice of this, you know. But at the same time, it's like, you know, if you're inviting people into stolen goods, that's an act of fraud. in addition to stealing the goods. So it's like, it's double jeopardy either way. At least the people who are already being stolen from and who are already in those territorial boundaries, they didn't really get a say in the matter. People who you're inviting in. And again, you know, there is also a cost-benefit analysis here of, well, then what's the case for closed borders if the closed borders are going to exceed the cost of just letting people in? And the answer is, well, of course, the government should not spend more than the optimal point on border security. But that is still somewhere above open borders. You know, like the optimal border security to prevent the consumption of taxpayer-funded resources is not zero. It's also not, again, like the trenches with alligators in them that people pretend Trump wanted.
Right.
You know, so it's like there is a middle ground there, but basically the state's immediate duty is to be as good a sort of fiduciary stakeholder as it can be and liquidate itself. You know, like that's sort of the moral and legal obligation of the state. And so that does mean that they do need to think about what are our restrictions for accessing this. And as far as letting, you know, taxpaying citizens, as much as I don't like the idea of citizenship, have it, and non-taxpaying non-citizens not have it, you know, it's like almost like a Punnett square where you have like non-taxpaying non-citizen probably shouldn't have access, citizen non-taxpayer access, you know, taxpaying non-citizen access and taxpaying citizen access. So like, it's not necessarily that the state shouldn't invite anyone in ever because we want to keep people out. It's, you need to be careful that you're not disposing of stolen goods in an unethical way.
So is this okay? So there's a lot there. I'm going to try to respond to all of it. So I guess the first thing, you kind of brought up two different, I guess, justifications, for lack of a better word, for why it would be okay for the person on one side of the border to have access to the public property and not the people on the other side of the border. One was sort of a circumstance of location or vicinity, and then two was sort of like the lack of other options, like, you know, people who, like, well, you know, if they don't have any other option but to use the public property, you know, then it's less bad for them to use it while they're already here versus bringing more people here to use it. Just very quickly, did I get that right? Because I always want to make sure I'm sort of like,
it was really more the second point that I was trying to make and sort of waddling towards. So really that
the second point matters more than the first one.
Yeah, so you're already here. And I mean,
the first one to me seems more like that kind of like, well, I don't know, it's just an arbitrary line in the sand. It doesn't really seem super compelling.
Like the arbitrary line in the sand thing, it's like, well, there's a lot of desert that I don't care about. You know, anyone can go settle in that desert. It won't be any skin off my bones. But if you are, you know, using infrastructure that I'm funding, maybe more moral hazard there.
But see, I could make an argument that the people born in this country have less of a need to the public property generally than like people, let's say, on the other side who live in Mexico, you know, or maybe very oftentimes, and sort of like as a consequence of the war on drugs and sort of like consequences of American, you know, policies that have made their situation even worse. I could argue from a, you know, sort of moral standpoint that those people actually have more of a lack of any other option and sort of a like, well, you know, maybe they would have the higher moral claim to sort of use this and then have a moral obligation to like view it as like they're borrowing this to pay back later, ideally. Maybe it's so ideal. So what would you say to that?
So my rebuttal to that would be, it's not that you're allowed to steal bread and then pay it back later. It's that when there is no other alternative. So for instance, if I had rice and I saw a loaf of bread, I would not have any ethical justification for stealing the loaf of bread while I have rice. You know, I may prefer bread, it may be more fulfilling, but if my needs are satiated. So like when I was making that case, it wasn't you have the right to go wherever you have the most opportunity. You are not aggressed against by lacking opportunity. However, you are aggressed against if there are bandits outside locking you in your house, which is sort of how I would view the state. You know, it's like you are, you know, if you are born within a state's territorial borders,
right?
You know, like if you leave the U.S., you actually still have to pay taxes, even if you leave, unless you renounce your citizenship, for instance. Okay, so like,
yeah.
In that sort of situation, it's like, well, you know, and again, that gets to like the refugee question. Like, I don't see, because of how I've formulated my thoughts on the immigration thing, I don't actually see a case for taking in immigrants as far as like, you can let immigrants in because they don't have any claim, but obviously it would be the polite thing to do. And, you know, in a libertarian social order, I would hope we would, but I don't think the government has a right to invite people in even just because they need it, you know, because they're, you know, they're giving away stolen property because, oh, you need it more than the people we stole it from. Instead, no, you're not allowed to do that. You know, that's very much, you're not allowed to steal except for very specific necessity right now. So it's like, or like, I would even necessarily, maybe the better parallel is to self-defense. You know, like if someone breaks into my house, am I justified to shoot? And the answer is yes. If I think someone's going to jump or going to break into my house, am I justified to shoot him? Probably not. You know, like there's, you know, like maybe he could have a sign where it's like, I'm going to break into your house and kill you while he's running across my lawn or whatever. And, you know, at that point, it's like, yeah, he's clearly, you know, it's just a question of has he actually like crossed the property line yet or not, but clearly the intent and everything is there. So it's like, with regards to the need, it's like, it's not so much that it's a need-based argument so much as because you are in this space, if you chose not to use any public goods, you know, it's like if I chose not to use any public goods, you know, I would not be able to step outside my house. And so I would be essentially kidnapped if I were absolutely prescribed from using public goods. Now, does that mean that I have a moral claim to those public goods? No, it doesn't. You know, like other than the fact that, you know, yes, technically I'm one of the taxpayers. Maybe not even a net taxpayer. I'm not terribly wealthy, but, you know, it's like I am nonetheless one of the people from whom money has been stolen in the past by the government. So, you know, if we liquidated it, I'd probably be entitled to a share back. But it's like, you know, if you're in a different country and you're looking at another country, it's like, well, you might be the victim of the same circumstances in your own country, but it doesn't entitle you to go halfway. Like, you know, to go back to the stealing bread analogy, it's like, well, if you're starving and there's a loaf of bread available and you steal it, that's still immoral. You know, it's not good. It's a moral violation that you owe restitution for. And there's a difference between doing it within an hour of need and going halfway around the world to do it. You know, it's like if you are in a country and the situation is truly unbearable, I would hope someone would invite you in, but you don't necessarily
maybe Australians should not have free access, you know, to come to America, but it seems to me that the people right across the border who are kind of that constitutes the majority of the people who are coming across the border coming and overstaying their visas.
Usually they're from Central America, not Mexico directly. But
okay. But I mean, it's...
Mexico is for as much as, you know, I live in the Southwest, as much as we may give Mexico grief, it's really much nicer than people ever credit for. You know, like it's not a particularly dangerous place unless they think you're a rich American, in which case they might try and kidnap you for a ransom. You know, but it's like if you...
Well, it's a slightly different debate because I've heard, I mean,
yeah.
I know people live in Mexico too, and I've heard it just kind of varies by where you live and also varied over time. So
it's ironic. The situations that the U.S. has created have made the border regions worse than the rest of Mexico, which is an indictment of our policy.
Sure.
You don't necessarily have a claim to go and steal just because, you know, and, you know, and again, like a libertarian social order, once you have all that property held by private people, anyone who invites you in, you're good to go to, you know. So, you know, like, obviously, as Christians, we all have churches we're associated with. you know, and like my church takes in homeless people. There's no reason my church couldn't take in refugees other than sort of the legal difficulties associated with that. So, you know, in the libertarian social order, we would want to do stuff like that as Christians and hopefully as a society. But for the state to do it, it's one of those things where you can't take stolen, like, again, like the stealing bread analogy. I can't steal bread and give it to 50 people for a popularity boost, you know, like.
Okay, so
it wouldn't be the same thing.
I see what you're trying to get at as far as the difference in traveling an hour versus traveling halfway across the world. I don't know if it's a strong enough argument that it would convince me, because I think where I'm coming down is there's two problems I see. One, let's say, I mean, and I'll just agree that for sake of argument, I think I agree anyway, but I'd have to think about it a bit more to be sure. But I think I agree that it is a form of theft. Or
hey there, did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
For an aggression of some sort for people to travel here from any distance, you know, but especially maybe more from a larger distance, to come here and to gain access to public property, public resources, etc. But what I'm unconvinced of is that that aggression is lesser. Let me try to phrase this correctly. I'm not certain that that aggression is then justifiably met by the aggression it takes from the state then to keep them out. Like I guess what I'm pointing out is that I think that what I'm not saying is that they have a right to it. I'm not saying that in a libertarian sense, I agree with you, people aren't owed something. But the issue is to keep the people out just inevitably, in my opinion, requires a certain level of enforcement, both at the border and then having also agencies to detain people who came legally and overstayed visas and this, that, and the other. And the apparatus that you have to create to then stop this aggression, this what I would view as a smaller aggression by the immigrant, then creates a larger aggression on the part of the state to sort of, so like you're creating a bigger problem to solve a smaller problem, especially because I think the cost of up now, I know you said that you would want what is minimally required. You wouldn't want, you know, an excessive amount spent, but the problem is, like, it's in my opinion easy to say, well, I don't want them to spend lots of money on this, but it's like, but this is what the state does, is it says, here's a problem, we're the solution, but and then they fail to actually solve it, and B, they create as much bureaucracy as they can, as much inefficiency as they can, and continue to create more ways to aggress against the taxpayers and to take more of their wealth. So to me, it's like, I feel like it's inevitable that the amount of aggression both towards the immigrants and towards the taxpayer will be greater as you try to solve the smaller aggression of the people coming here to have some sort of access to the public goods. If I could be shown, you know, obviously, you know, I believe in empirical reality. So if someone showed me how, like, you know, demonstrated a way, not just hypothetically, but like showed me, hey, we did it, you know, I would acknowledge it, but I'm highly skeptical that would ever work out. At the very least, now I will say, in the sense that I'm not a like absolutist, I think that totally open borders are perhaps a pipe dream here in America, and so I would, you know, be okay with compromises to try to have, again, as humanitarian and as decentralized a border policy as possible. I don't know if I would necessarily even call that a closed border policy, but I guess that's a bit of a semantics game as to what we mean by open versus closed. But I guess it's sort of, I always say, like, well, which direction are you leaning? And I'm going to be leaning, you know, pushing more towards the government having less control over who comes here than more control, only because I think the more control we give them is always going to end up in a greater aggression than the ones we're trying to solve. So that's
So I would say that's more of an issue with the methodology being used than necessarily the enforcement. Like, you're not necessarily against the idea of some people can't just come in and take public goods that don't have a claim to. It's more, you know, we don't want to see migrants. I mean, like, I live in the Southwest. One of the things that's really horrifying is to hear the actual stories of the people who are trafficked here illegally. You know, and even if they're coming of their own free will, they have all sorts of horrible things happen to them on the way. And my gut feeling there, if we're going to get into a utilitarian argument, but also I think there's more room for this also from an economic perspective to analyze, is, you know, if we can get rid of inefficiencies, which is a big if because we're dealing with government here, when we're seeing very large government responses to immigration, that means one, either that they fail more often than they succeed. So the actual methods are very ineffective. And so only, you know, if 1 in 100 potential illegal immigrants gets punished, you're going to try and punish that 1 in 100 disproportionately, which is, I would agree, morally wrong. Or if you have a proportional response to try and deter something, that means that the economic incentives are very high. So, for instance, to take a more sort of non-aggressive stance to border enforcement, it looks a lot less like walls and more like maybe a lot of the public services are not free anymore. You know, so sort of like to go back to the idea of, you know, the boomer.
But that wouldn't be really closed borders anymore, though, would it? Like, if it's just a matter of making, because I don't necessarily disagree with you that, but like, if you're going to take public goods and make them less of a commons and make them more approximating something like private property where people have to pay to use them, that I don't have as much of an issue with. I think it's different.
So I mean, like, you know, one would be like, so for instance, like public schools right now, we don't verify citizenship or legal status to use public schools. And so, you know, if you started cutting away at stuff like that, you would have sort of a two-pronged enforcement. And, you know, to a lot of libertarians, that would sound very unlibertarian of like, you are discriminating against people on the basis of citizenship here. But the reality is that what you're doing is you're not viewing that as in some people get benefits, other people don't necessarily, though I'm not necessarily opposed to that from the net taxpayer perspective. I just don't generally consider net taxpayer to be a good argument. It's not something that I consider core to my philosophy. But you know, you're not thinking of that. You're not using that as a way to say these people are privileged and these people are unprivileged. You're saying this is part of our border enforcement mechanism, is to make as many public services either paid for so that they're, I mean, and then they're not taxpayer subsidized, you know, which is another win, I think, as far as the libertarian goal would be. Or you make them contingent on proof of citizenship, which reduces the draw for illegal immigration and makes the border,
kind of see, you know, connection
you move away from the draconian, you know, guys in riot armor enforcement to the, well, you can come, but there's no reason for you to be here unless you have actually come legally, which would help us transition.
So I actually like that. That's actually something that the states already do. For example, like, some state parks here or some publicly funded state things here, like in my state, they'll be like free if you're a, you know, a citizen of Pennsylvania. But if you're out of state, then they charge a certain fee for use of those things. And so that is something, like, I can see how you're sort of conflating it with border enforcement. It's I don't know. I feel like it's a bit of a semantical game there. That sort of enforcement, whatever we call it, you know, I have no problem with that. I would agree that those are libertarian or at least libertarian-esque, you know, more better libertarian answers than other ones.
Yeah, well, and it's like, it's one of those things where it's like, to get the library card, you have to show proof of residency. And of course, part of the reason they do that is so people don't walk in and, you know, steal one library card worth of books and then come back and steal another, you know. But, you know, practically speaking, stuff like that is probably how, you know, it's a more libertarian way to do it, because you're not really thinking we want to exclude these people entirely from society, but you need to prove a valid claim to public services. So in that sense, you can't just come and get stuff. And, you know, I actually have sort of in what I consider to be the libertarian ideal here. Because I think the two strong cases you've already sort of mentioned are forced association. You want to prevent that. No one has a right to associate with anyone else. That's not something that's a valid positive right. You do have a negative right of choosing not to associate with someone. And a legal right not to be held responsible for associating with someone, but that's legislative and not really natural. You know, obviously there's a locality preference. And I think that's something that a lot of people who say that the people who don't like forced integration are racist don't realize. A lot of people really feel more comfortable dealing with people that they know. You know, and like, if you've ever been to a small town, like, they often don't have police there, you know, and it's like, well, the reason why you have Mayberry with Andy Griffith and Barney Fife and not a whole police department is because everyone knows each other. You know, the odds are that something really serious is going to need intervention is nil. And they primarily prefer to work with people who know each other or who have some tie to the community. That's not necessarily that they're xenophobic and hate everyone who looks different from them. You know, I've been to small towns where it's relatively diverse internally, but they still don't like outsiders. And it's simple. They're saving a lot of time and effort on trying to figure out who's good and who's bad and what might lead to legal troubles by just not associating with outsiders.
Or at the very least, if outsiders are going to come in, there's a difference between a sort of organic through the market people coming in and moving in a controlled pattern versus like, oh my gosh, like, you know, a couple hundred people just showed up in the middle of town and they don't have a place to live. And that creates a certain bit of uncertainty. And, you know, I mean, the forced integration argument like I said earlier, it's absolutely a concern that a lot of open borders libertarians they just dismiss as that's racist. And it's like, that's just naive. Like, it shows how complete, like a lot of those Cato types, they're just, you know, they're extreme cosmopolitans. They don't understand.
I'm extreme cosmopolitan, but I don't engage in motivated reasoning and ignore all the other alternatives there.
Right.
You know,
right.
Like, there is something to be said for, if I'm in a small town, I don't have police officers on my speed dial. I don't have any of this stuff. We rely on just knowing everyone around us and having an opinion of them already. Adding in, you know, 50,000 people a day going through a 4-square-mile area is not something that works with that social order. And so there are reasons to be concerned about that. And of course, the ironic thing is, in an open border society, if we did achieve one, those places would probably not be seeing massive influxes of people. It's, you know, really the government that tends to insert people to those places through like refugee resettlement that creates the problems that people worry about. But, you know, it's still a valid complaint. And knowing that the fundamental goal of human action is to reduce discomfort, you don't have a right to take policies that cause people a lot of discomfort. You know, it's like, that they maybe would have a claim to be aggressed against if you were inserting people into their community, not because they want to maintain any particular balance or anything, but they want, you know, to be able to enjoy that security.
Right. And also, to be clear, like, what I would not be in favor of, and this to me would be beyond just open borders, what I would be against the state actively promoting and trying to incite more immigration. Which I know some people would say open borders inherently does that, but I think there's a difference between a sort of open borders that's just kind of like a casual sort of like, you know,
like a laissez-faire
approach versus a, hey, everybody come here. There's, you know, I'm in favor of the former, not so much the latter. That would be certainly an unlibertarian approach.
So. Well, and to use the boomer cliche, so long as we have social services being provided by the government, you sort of do need to have some closure of borders to people so that people don't just come for the free stuff. But that's not really what I'm worried about when I refer to restricting access. Like, I don't really call it closed borders. I call it access controls because I do believe in.
I was about to ask that, which, like, it seems like a lot of times what I find is that, like, the debate between open and closed borders is silly because, like, truly, like most reasonable libertarians can kind of like what we just did here. It's kind of like, well, we really aren't advocating for totally open and we're not really advocating for totally closed. We're just saying, like, there's some nuance here that we have to recognize in terms of, like, what we do while the state exists. And, like, and yeah, so pretty much,
yeah, well, and
I agree again, with, like, I agree with 99% of what you're proposing, even if we have some slight disagreements around the edges.
Yeah. Well, and I guess the point that I want to make is I do think there is actually a libertarian principled position for absolutely zero immigration while the state still exists. Now, it's kind of like the hyper extremist position of, like, the state needs to be liquidated tomorrow. And then we can worry about letting people into the, you know, it's like, it's literally like that you've walked in on a crime scene, you're putting up the police or crime scene, you know, crime scene, no trespassing or whatever tape, and you're liquidating stuff. And then, you know, the day after things go back to letting people do stuff. So, you know, I think there, the big gripe that I just have is when people say closed borders aren't libertarian. It's like, no, there is actually a very principled libertarian case for absolute closed borders. It's kind of value maxing in the sense of, like, you would have to put one thing on a pedestal above all others, which isn't realistic. You know, like, my case is that you can have completely non-aggressive access controls that, just depending on the situation, could be, you know, you might wind up with zero immigration under those controls, or you might wind up with practically unfettered immigration.
I see what you're saying. I just think the issue is when you phrase that as closed borders, that's not what the term sort of communicates.
Yeah.
For better or for worse, like, people, because it's really more what you, it's not stopping people from crossing a border. It's saying within the borders there is limited access. You know, it's basically saying, taking the commons and making them not free to everyone. And that's completely, in my opinion, I think it's wrong to label that as closed borders. But I do understand how you're saying it would have an effect on the border and on immigration, which is true.
Well, I was going to say, it's more of how do we enforce closed borders? Because obviously, you know, the beautiful wall is sort of a meme, but it's,
but you're not really enforcing the border, practical. You're enforcing the commons. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, that's
so, like, yeah, is sort of like, you know, and again, like, I'm fairly cosmopolitan. My own preference is pro-immigration. But from, like, a libertarian ethical principle, I think I'm actually maybe more pro-immigration than a strictly ethical case might permit. Because I'm saying, you know, like, yeah, I don't mind if I get soaked because people are coming in illegally. And so when the time comes, fingers crossed, that we transition from a state to a libertarian social order, you know, it's like, I don't mind giving up what I've put into the state. Like, if I, you know, at this point with the government's, like, if it stopped existing, I would be happy. I don't care how it stops existing, you know, which I'm sure is something that just landed me on a watch list. But, you know, it's like, not aggressively, at the end of the BOAT, like, you realize, hey, these guys are scam artists. If we stop complying tomorrow, they'd all stop being a problem for us. You know, it's like, if we just stop, you know, Nancy Pelosi's not going to come to my house with a Glock to collect taxes. You know, like, you don't need to have some violent revolution to end the state. You just sort of have to say, like, look, this is all kind of nonsense. And when enough people get together and say, look, this is all kind of nonsense, it comes to an end. You know, and until then, I don't think there's a crime to say, look, everything that's public good, which is an awful term that we hate, but, you know, let's use the way it's colloquially used. Everything that the state pretends it owns and gives away, anyone who's not a lawful citizen should be denied that. That's not, I don't think, an unlibertarian position.
Or denied free access to it versus
allowing free access to it. You know, it's like, you could do a paid access system.
And listen, if there's people that say, oh, I don't like that they don't have free access, it's like, well, you can contribute.
Yeah,
you can pay for it yourself, or you know, there can be organizations out there that, you know, would provide financial assistance to, you know, aid in the accessing of those public resources for the immigrants. You know, there are, you know, and to me, this is the beautiful thing about what you're describing is not only is it like a, it's not only a solution of sorts to the immigration problem and the tragedy of the commons, but it's also to me like hand in hand with sort of a political strategy for promoting more decentralization and privatization. So it's sort of like a, it's sort of like a two-pronged pushback against the authoritarian control that the state has over these things.
Yeah. Well, and again, I hate to say this, kind of post-libertarian in the sense of I'm not post-libertarian. I'm hardcore libertarian. I want to move towards that, but I'm also a political realist. You know, like if you've followed my Twitter account, you'll notice that I can talk about like as a political realist, you know, so it's like you can enforce things without men with guns and body armor. You know, like we think about that because we think of policing. And it's like sometimes when people are violent, you do need men with guns and armor. You know, like I know Walter Block talks about how in a libertarian social order you'll all have nonviolent police officers, but it's like, no, you probably still will have someone who's out there to deal with the mad guy with a gun. You know, it's like at some point you will need to have some level of that going on. But, you know, it's like the actual enforcement mechanism should be more focused on how do you clamp down incentives. You know, it's like, because ideally the libertarian ideal, as far as I can tell, is if someone has a productive enterprise or real estate or other non-movable property that they can sort of reside in, they should have access to that. So if someone were to buy a house, it doesn't matter if they're a citizen or not, they should be able to come live here. Of course, you can't just like buy a baseball and then come into the US, but you would, if it's something that's retrievable, you don't have a claim to enter, you do have a claim to have it sent to you. You know, one thing that I think a lot of conservatives get upset about when libertarians are open borders that we do need to address is people can't be engaged in criminal enterprises. Of course, we consider a lot fewer things criminal than the conservatives do. You know, say, I don't care if you're bringing drugs across the border, so long as they're clearly labeled and you're not defrauding anyone. Like, yeah, I don't like drugs. Don't do drugs. I don't even drink. I'm a Nazarene. We don't, you know, we don't drink alcohol. It's like, so I'm not necessarily endorsing the drugs, but at the same time, it's like.
So you're not going to buy the Rabbit Eye blueberry wine I advertised at the beginning of the show?
No, unfortunately not. I thought about cracking a joke about it. And I thought, maybe don't take off the sponsor. But, you know, it's like, I'm obviously not endorsing drugs, but it's like, at the same time, it's like, you're not defrauding anyone by selling. You know, it's like, they're not inherently criminals. So if you stop prosecuting that, you'd have a lot fewer issues with stuff in general. And then also, obviously, anyone who comes in must pay a price. Now, of course, in the private society, you might have people who pay for roads. You know, like if I'm a business owner, I might pay for the roads around my business so that people come to my business so they don't have to pay for those roads. You know, Rothbard talks about this in, I think it's the Libertarian Manifesto, or I forget what it's called, but he talks about how, you know, it's like private parks or private spaces draw in all these businesses that pay for their operations. So the people who actually use them, from our perspective as sort of consumers, don't have to pay for them, but they're being paid for by someone else. You know, so there are those rooms there, but I do think there is a case for, like, from a libertarian perspective of saying these people are not from here. They don't have access to the property the same way. Like, as much as that may pain some of us to say, it's like outsiders do not have the same claim to property as people who were born here for various reasons. And we need to consider, while we're on the road to hopefully privatizing everything and then anyone can go wherever they're invited, which is the ideal, we need to say, no, you actually can't just come here. And we're going to come up with ways to stop that while we change it so you can't just be invited anywhere you want and there's no moral issues there.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I feel like we mostly agree. I might have some slight framing disagreements with you, but I can kind of get behind the spirit and the sort of direction that you're going at. So, you know, maybe one thing to talk about here at the end, sort of, you know, you kind of hinted at it, and it's something that I often think about too, is sort of like there's that, you know, right now in our movement, there's sort of this, there's two polar ends right now. There's the, you know, sort of post-libertarians who have sort of, like, in my opinion, gotten so they're almost like reacting to the other end, which is like the Lalbert. And you have like the Lalbert, the Cato types, the, I don't know, more regime libertarians, like Dave Smith calls them, who are kind of like, you know, completely like they're the ones that like what's that phrase that Pete Quinonez uses, living in Encapistan in your head. That's sort of like what the Lalberts do. And then the post-libertarians, they kind of go the opposite end. They're like, well, libertarianism, Encapistan is just, you know, impossible to achieve, and we just need to live in reality right here, right now. It's, you know, it's almost like a sort of like brutal, like a brutalist approach, so to speak. And they, yeah, you kind of have these two extremes. I get the post-libertarian critique, and I've tried to listen to them. What I've tried to do is incorporate and sort of integrate what their criticisms are, and to kind of find that middle ground, because I don't think, you know, and this seems to me sort of what you're trying to do here with the whole border thing, which I can appreciate, is sort of like trying to find that balance between, well, what are our principles? What can we do to make the status quo as good as we can? But, you know, can we always be pushing to go further? And whether that further ever reaches an actual society where the state dissolves, well, I don't know. It might seem far-fetched now, but it's happened in the past. There have been societies that have existed for decades or even centuries without the state. But even if we can't get there, it's like, well, keep pushing. You know, don't just, you know, deal with the here and now, deal with the circumstances that we have, but continue to push as much as you can, in any way you can, for, you know, more decentralization. And on top of that, not just decentralization, but I like the way you put it, like there are ways we can sort of hack the state mechanism and create enforcements that are at least not, you know, fundamentally as violent as other enforcement mechanisms are. I do think that that is a bit more, that is something that the post-libertarians have sort of rightfully pushed on the libertarian movement to be like, you know, there are ways to utilize the state in the here and now that aren't just, you know, complete violations of, well, I think sometimes the post-libertarians go, yeah, well, who cares if it violates the principles? And to me, I've kind of come to a conclusion where, well, I think there are ways you can use the state that don't violate your principles and that are, you know, maybe not perfect, but they're, you know, they're good enough, right? Like, we don't need to make the perfect the enemy of the good. So I don't know. Yeah. Those are some of the things I've been thinking about. What are your thoughts?
I actually, when I was sketching out some notes, I actually wrote about this. Now, obviously, my background is I'm a former Tolstoyan. And so if you're a Tolstoyan, you think very deontologically. Like, you don't make utilitarian, you don't make consequentialist arguments. It's always
right.
What is moral. And that's, right. You know, that's one of the things that drew me to Rothbard versus, like, I read Hayek and, you know, yeah, I sort of enjoyed his economic analyses, but not his political analyses. And so one of the things that I think is a good recipe for those of us who might be, you know, sort of, those of us who get tarred as Lalberts, to avoid that and stay away from the libertarian spectrum, is think about what thought process you're using to get to your goals, and think about whether emotion is entering into it as a central thing or not. Because, you know, I am 100% like, I will make a utilitarian or a consequentialist argument alongside deontology as a way of sanity checking it.
Right.
But I always first and foremost start with what is a moral thing. So for instance, with my sort of closed borders approach, there's two underlying things there. One is you don't have any claim to other people's property legally. So being told, no, you can't come here, that's not a violation against it. You know, even the use of force to prevent that, it sort of depends on whether that's proportional, but it would be valid. It would be valid in a proportional sense. The state is awful at any sense of proportional justice. you know, like for instance, incarceration. Like, I don't necessarily have a philosophical objection to incarceration, but there's like no circumstance where it's proportional. You know, it's like maybe violent crimes. But even then, like if I were the victim of a violent crime and my choice was the person who hurt me pays restitution or the person who hurt me goes to jail, I would choose restitution, like hands down every time. You know, like there's, and that is personal preference maybe, but like, you know, it's not like, you know, it's not like I would necessarily even have a claim to incarcerate someone who punched me for 20 years. You know, that just doesn't logically follow as a proportional punishment. And I think that's one of those questions there. And the other thing is moral universality, where anyone can take any moral action. So like self-defense, we don't consider self-defense to be immoral because, you know, it would be justifiable. And most people wouldn't consider like a police officer or a private security person intervening to save someone's life immoral either, even if they did harm to a criminal that way. Precisely because, you know, if you view things through a morally universalist and a deontological framework, you know, it's like, yes, you can argue, well, some people have dirty hands or whatever, so you can make an exception for that. But like, if someone has no ulterior motive, they can take any morally correct action. And even if they have maybe ulterior motives or dirty hands, if it's morally correct, they can still do it, you know? And so that's one of the things where, like, I'm not a post-libertarian. Like, I very much want, you know, I'm not even full Hoppian in some far as I would go, you know? It's like,
yeah,
I want even maybe a little more Liberty society than Hoppe, you know. So I don't believe necessarily to be in a covenant community. I'd like to live in a gated covenant community, but then the rest of the world, you know, it's like, yeah, like I'm fine with, you know, polycentric legal order, polycentric social order. I'm totally down with that, you know, which I know a lot of post-libertarians would tear their hair out.
Right. And yeah, that's, I 100% agree with what you just said there, which is my problem too. It's like the whole, like I would actually want to probably live in a more Hoppian covenant community style, you know, town or whatever. And I get a lot of value from Hoppe, but yeah, I also, I don't feel a need to universalize that across the entirety of, you know, the globe, or at least not, you know, not nearly to the degree it seems that some of the post-libertarians do. Yeah, I think it's kind of like trying to integrate the best of all of these different ideas rather than like becoming a ideologue of just one, you know what I mean? Like, I think we can take the wisdom of Tolstoy, and we can take the insights of Hoppe and late Rothbard, but we can even take, you know, insights from Hayek and, you know, and try to incorporate them. And, I don't know. I think there's some stuff from Hayek I do appreciate, although
I
Hayek can be somewhat, you know, like I know he'll be endlessly cited by the Lulbert, so I get why some in our spaces have sort of tried to steer away from him. But yeah, I just think it's like, you know, and I love your approach, like deontology first, but to me, it's always like you always strive for both. Especially because I agree, like if you're all like if you're just pure deontology and zero utilitarianism, it's like, well, maybe your deontological framework is a little skewed, because if deontology always leads you into, you know, spaces that are completely only utilitarian, I don't know. I get a sense that like true utilitarianism and true deontology should, like, they should convene, you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, and I mean, I think one thing that, you know, would be a good suggestion for really anyone, but especially those of us who are maybe libertarian, rejecting the post-libertarian, but more like on the right, like I use the term austro-libertarian for those of us who are maybe more traditional minded right-leaning than like the Libertarian Party has been for the last 50 years or whatever. You know, or like, you know, often you'll hear the term Mises Caucus, which is like, I'm not technically part of the Mises Caucus, but it's something where it's like, if you applied it to me as a label, it's like, yeah, I'd prefer them over the other libertarian guys, you know. But I mean, have you seen the other libertarian guys? Like, that's You know, it's like, you know, it's like, that's not a shining endorsement.
No.
Though I will say, it was actually David Hines is one of the Meacocks who got me onto Rothbard. So I do owe the caucus some debts there. But I would actually suggest read something by political realists. A lot of people cite Burnham's Machiavellians. I don't like Burnham very much. I know that's kind of controversial. I think he maybe has a little motivated reasoning in some of his conclusions he reaches. The Machiavellians is a great book, but what I always recommend is if you just want like an introduction to political realism and elite theory, someone who both Rothbard explicitly cites, I don't know if Hoppe ever cites him or just makes some passing references to him. I recommend Gaetano Masca's The Ruling Class, which is like 500 page, like it serves to politics what Man, Economy, and State is to economics. It's like a political treatise. It's in the Machiavellian tradition. So if you're sort of familiar with thinking about the prince and whatnot, it's sort of a development of that into looking at how our society is ordered and how do we draw out from that. And you know, if you're a libertarian and you have these beautiful ideas, beautiful economics, but then you're wondering why do our politics always wind up in a burning flaming mess? You know, why is it that we have public nudity at the LP conventions instead of you know, some glorious leader coming forward to lead us on to the next golden age? It's like read political realism and understand what's going on in the background there. Because like one of the things that the post-libertarians say is, oh, well, you know, you can't have perfect freedom because people will abuse it. And it's like true in the sense of you can't have positive freedom. You can have a lot of negative liberty before you open up problems. But, you know, at the same time, it's like the post-libertarians, you know, I don't think any of them have ill intentions. Like, I don't think they're like on their pathway to being like alt-right neo-Nazis or anything, which no. I know is a smear that some of them get tarred with. But at the same time, it's like they don't have the, and some of them are better about this than others. You know, like a lot of the big name people, I think, are very like Pete Quinones, who blocked me on Twitter. I will give him credit for this. Like he goes through and reads like Hoppe, What Must Be Done and whatnot, which is sort of a political realist book. But getting that backbone really helps you understand. And especially one of the things that, and I've mentioned this once on Caleb's podcast once, Faith, Liberty, Praxis. One of the things that is important to know is the distinction between like a civic religion and a humanitarian religion. You know, because obviously, like here, a lot of us, our humanitarian religion is Christianity, but we also have a civic religion, you know, and a lot of people have a civic religion of like democracy or neoliberalism or whatnot that is defining a lot of their judgments. And that's not necessarily wrong. I mean, obviously, I'm Austro libertarians tend to be a little more skeptical of democracy than mainstream libertarians, but you need to make sure what those assertions are when you're going in. Because if your assertion is, well, equality is really good for everyone, well, you might wind up seeing that backfire pretty quickly if you're saying, oh, everyone is equal. It's like, well, everyone maybe deserves a fair shake. But that in itself has all sorts of definitional issues. And believe me, when there's a fire in your house, not all firemen are equal, you know. And from a political perspective, not all people are equal, you know. You do need to have some way of dealing with aggressors, which is what the post-libertarians are correct about.
Yes.
The problem is you don't necessarily want an apex predator to deal with aggressors. You know, that's sort of where the post-libertarian theory breaks down for me. It's like, yes, you should kind of have, like, you should be able to go bump in the dark, but it shouldn't be your way of
doing
things by default.
Well, it's sort of like, I don't know, are you familiar with Jordan Peterson at all?
Yeah, that you should be a monster.
Yeah, like incorporating right? The shadow or integrating the shadow. It's kind of like what, to me, it's like libertarians needed to do that. Post-libertarians kind of went too far and they're like, they're not integrating the shadow. They're like, elevating it, I think, a little bit too high, which is, and I can appreciate, and again, they're not all the same. Some of them, I think, do a better job than others, like you put it. But I think it is sort of like we do need to do a better job of incorporating political realism and incorporating an understanding of, yeah, Hapa, what must be done, like knowing that, like, it, you know, we aren't just going to, like, kumbaya our way to a stateless society. Like, you know, there's going to need to be some, like I said, like when you're in a war, which is kind of what we're in, there's a difference between what you do on the battlefield and what you do in peacetime. And we have to recognize that we're in the battlefield right now. And so unfortunately the rules are different, but that doesn't mean that we should just, you know, we shouldn't basically be like, to take a historical analogy, we shouldn't become Sherman burning down the South.
Yeah.
Like, oh, that's
me, yeah. Once you read about that, it's a little bit of a black pill. To realize how many people just idolize the Civil War and the Union, and it's like, they did some bad stuff too, guys. Like, I know, yeah, the whole slavery thing. Well, and I mean, that's a lesson maybe for libertarians to look at, is like, well, why was Lysander Spooner, who's this great abolitionist and perfectly in line with us, he was not necessarily pro-Confederacy, but he was very against Lincoln. Like, he was, yeah, not happy with Lincoln. And so we should ask ourselves, why is he concerned about this? I think another thing, to go from Jordan Peterson back a step further to Jung, yep, and you can maybe also bring in like Chesterton and whatnot here, you'll sort of make up a religion if you don't have one. And
absolutely,
I think one of the post-libertarian responses to libertarianism, which is totally valid, is that a lot of libertarians are, you know, sort of Rothbard's modal libertarian, where if it's freedom and I like it, it's good. If it's freedom and I don't like it, it's bad. If it's unfree and I like it, it's freedom. And if it's unfree and I don't like it, well, that's not a problem for us anyway, because we're optimizing freedom.
Right.
You know, really good libertarians don't have that problem so much, because we understand, you know, it's really about aggression. You know, like Hoppe has this lecture in which she says, basically, it's like, you know, libertarianism is just basically applying the Ten Commandments correctly. And I'm sort of putting words in his mouth there, but he sort of goes through how, like, thou shalt not steal and whatnot, a lot of these are fundamentally aligned with libertarian moral axioms. And so these people who are, you know, the Lala, I forget what he calls them, but, you know, it's like the people who are trying to argue that we should, you know, it's like, don't get me wrong, like, obviously legislative laws, awful, but we're not getting rid of legislative law to have no law. We're getting rid of legislative law to have underlying moral principle, whether you want to call it natural law, God's commandments, you know, whatever you want to call that. That's what we're trying to get to as libertarians. We're not trying to get to nothing. You know, we're not nihilists. And that's something I think a lot of libertarians should remember, is like, it's not about a battle, it's about a campaign. And the goal of any campaign is not the enemy. The goal is you. You know, the goal is, how are we going to make a libertarian social order, which is our ideal, versus, you know, like any individual law. Like a lot of people, you know, like DeSantis and whatnot, people love him, people hate him. You know, I kind of like him just from the leftist tears on Twitter. But also, it's like, I wouldn't necessarily want him to be my governor. You know, it's like, in an ideal world, we'd get rid of him too.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's like, you do need to pay attention to that, of like, not every step has to be a step forward. You can make a tactical retreat, but you don't want to set the retreat as your end goal.
Yeah, no, I agree with like everything you just said. So we're coming up on time here. Yeah, this ended up being a lot different than what I was expecting, but I'm glad, because I think it was a really good conversation. I think that these are kind of started out as a borders debate and kind of turned into, I think, a really important discussion that, you know, honestly, I'll probably, you know, maybe I should have you back on at some point to go a little bit deeper into, because these are definitely the ideas that I've been wrestling with and trying to sort of, like, you know, in my spaces as someone who's in the Mises Caucus, you know, and but who has a lot of friends in the post-libertarian sphere, you know, I've been trying to wrestle with these ideas and try to get people to sort of, you know, see the things that I'm seeing. So, but yeah, I appreciate, I really appreciate you coming on and talking about everything we ended up talking about. You know, where can people, you know, find you, follow you? And I think you do some little bit of writing and stuff, don't you?
Yeah.
So where can people find all that?
Writing, at K Willie Writes is where you'll find me on Twitter. I have a podcast I don't really update. It's related to just writing in general, storytelling. I also have a games company, Lore Shaper Games, where I'm putting stuff out pretty frequently. I have like 5 releases this year so far. It's tabletop role-playing game stuff. But mostly Twitter would be the best place to find me. And whenever I do anything else, I post about it on Twitter. So if you're looking for me and you want to see all my stuff, follow me on Twitter. You'll see it all eventually. I do have a Substack as well. I'm going to probably put my sort of prep notes that I sketched out while I was thinking about what would be the libertarian case for closed borders. I'm probably going to put those up there tonight or tomorrow so people can see sort of my whole thoughts on the things. I mean, again, my own position is actually pretty close to open borders because obviously, you know, in a private society, if you're invited in, you get to come in. With a couple exceptions, obviously, if you're like fugitive from justice, maybe that creates issues. But I think it's important for us as libertarians to be able to make as broad an array of libertarian cases as possible so that we don't, you know, gatekeep people who are good libertarians operating off principle because we don't like one of their positions. Because I saw a lot of people, like, I think the original impetus for this back in like September was because Dave Smith was fighting Cato and Reason people, and a lot of relatively good libertarians were like coming at Dave Smith over it. And it's like, actually, there are good libertarian cases to not agree with anything Cato or Reason says. Like, if Cato or Reason says it, there's a good libertarian argument against it. Like, the exception being maybe, I think Reason's pretty good on guns. It's like, if Cato or Reason are saying it, I can guarantee you there's a good libertarian case against whatever they're saying. You know, it's like, every time.
Yeah.
So,
and I think we both did a good job at highlighting the sort of good faith the good faith arguments on both sides, because it is a complicated issue. And yeah, I've always, you know, to me, it's not something to gatekeep over. And you can be there are completely rational, cogent arguments for closed borders, even different than the one you made tonight. You know what I mean? And they're ones that I usually reject, but it's like it's not like they're just authoritarian statists that. Or just like, you know, people just label like, oh, you're just a Trumper. I mean, it's just intellectually lazy. And it's just because people are emotionally immature and triggered by you know, anything that isn't just like, I mean, Cato and Reason are sort of like, you know, it's like their echo chamber. And they're so, what's the medical term for like, if you can't like handle anything like if you're germaphobe or, you know,
I was just going to go back toward Carl Jung and just say neurotic. Which, you know, and that is one thing to point out is a lot of people who are really good principled libertarians wind up with takes that a lot of this view is really weird. And it's often like one little point of economics or one little point of political theory or one little point of legal theory that we disagree with them on, and that shapes a lot. Of sort of the downstream conclusions. You know, like if you're a mercantilist and you don't believe in economic competition being better for everyone, you know, suddenly it's like, well, wait a minute, our states protect us from outsiders, you know, engaging in economic business. And of course, most libertarians are smart enough not to do that. But, you know, it's like, don't presume just because someone has an unpopular opinion that there's no principled justification for that. You know, it's like, I see this with, Ace, a lot of people get really upset with Ace on Twitter over his open borders stance. And it's like, I don't understand it, his extreme open borders. Like, he has like an extreme, like, the government cannot enforce borders thing. And I went to look at it and I started into numbers and said, I'm not doing this. I'm sorry. I like Ace, but I can't read Substack. Like, it doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah, numbers, and it's just,
what they mean.
We all, you know, need to, like, do better. Yeah, Twitter, unfortunately, some people do it better than others, but we all need to be better. Like, I don't know, like another good example is, I know he blocked you, which he does this to a lot of people, but like Pete Quinones, like, I love Pete. Like, I've had him on my show. I go on his show when it's live sometimes and interact with him in the comments. And, you know, we disagree on a lot, but like, you can value someone who has a different perspective from you because it, you know, again, it's that iron sharpening iron, that that's sort of like, you know, challenging your ideas, making sure that they're not stale, you know, and, you know, you can sometimes, even in disagreement with people, learn from them and, you know, learn to integrate and incorporate the, you know, something that, like, one of Jordan Peterson's rules is treat every person like they know something that you don't know. And it's like, it doesn't mean that you need to completely agree with them, but just that they might have a perspective or a nugget of the truth that you haven't considered yet. And even if it doesn't change your entire worldview, it might allow you to better distill, or better, you know, to even further materialize the thing you're trying to bring into reality. So we could keep going on this for like 45 minutes, yeah, but we're already over time. Also, so I gotta cut it.
Yeah. Part of it also is just like the whole gatekeeping thing. It's like, we don't own the whole world. It's okay that people disagree with us. Even right. People who are maybe competing for the same labels and same spaces and whatnot. Like, unless you're Elon Musk, you don't own the whole planet, and Elon Musk will only own Mars.
This is all moot point, because Elon Musk is just going to own the whole world in the next couple of years. So can you buy Disney next, please?
Oh gosh, I wish. The sentence is helping drop their stock value. So
yeah, maybe. Hey,
post libertarians make Musk king of Disney. Come on, let's do it.
Let's do it. Yep. Yeah. All right. Well, hey, thanks for coming on again, Kyle. And yeah, we'll definitely do this again sometime. And thanks everybody for watching.
Thanks for having me.
Yep, you're welcome. And until next time, everybody, remember, don't fear the fire.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.